Welcome to Project Geospatial, where we explore the intersection of technology, geography, and innovation. I'm the host of this segment, Adam Simmons, and in today's episode, we have the pleasure of speaking with Pete Morrison. Pete Morrison is the co-founder and chief product officer of BISEM. Hopefully I get that right. You can correct me in a bit. He's an evangelist. I'm sorry, go for it.
Yeah, BISEM or BISEM, either works.
BISEM, right on. He is an evangelist for the use of game technologies and other commercial off-the-shelf type products and software in the simulation and training industry. Now, Pete, I'm going to let you give the rest of your introduction, talk a little bit about your background and how you got involved with this industry, and then we'll kick off the main content.
Yeah, thank you, Adam. I'm really happy to be here. Yes, so I'm Pete. I started out in the Australian Army. I was a Signals Corps officer, but I really enjoyed computers and more specifically computer games. And I was one of the first in the Australian Army to use computer games to train soldiers, specifically in 2004 and 2005 when we were training soldiers to deploy to Iraq. I left the Army shortly thereafter, began working with Bohemia Interactive, and I helped form Bohemia Interactive Simulations. I was the CEO of that business from 2007 to 2012, and since then I've been focused on products. Hence, I'm now the Chief Product Officer, worrying about the long-term roadmaps and how to update the technology in accordance with new and emerging customer requirements.
Awesome. Now, how long have you been doing that since you left the military?
Well, yeah, I've been working for Bohemia now for 17, 18 years, so quite some time. Although I feel like it's gone in a flash, and it's been a real privilege to serve the men and women who protect us over all of these years.
Absolutely. Now that entails a lot. So you sounds like you're at the precipice, or you're in between multiple industries here in what you do, between gaming and simulation, but also training and also preparing military for what to expect downrange, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So we started out really focused on the training aspect. Although saying that, when we were training the soldiers who were deploying to Iraq, we actually recreated in a variant of the computer game Operation Flashpoint, game of the year 2001, upon which our product VBS was originally based. We actually recreated the entire town of Asamoah in Iraq within the computer game, and the soldiers were able to practice their convoys and drive the route from the airfield to the forward operating base, all within the computer game, which is really mission rehearsal. But VBS, which is our main product, Virtual Battle Space, is typically used for training. The idea being that you will make your mistakes in the computer game before you're in the field or you're in theater, and hence the computer game is really for cognitive learning. We're not teaching the soldiers how to shoot the rifle or any of the kinetic type skills, but it's really good to present them with a tactical problem that they need to solve in the computer game. And that's really where this computer game technology has been fantastically successful over these years.
Excellent. Now, I want to dive into that a little bit more, but as we're touching into this realm of the virtualization and such, it touches in the main topic of this concept of the metaverse. Now, what you've been talking about for this training and simulation is valid for decades. And as well as a lot of other examples of, for example, geospatial visualization, world building per se, but it has evolved into this concept that has emerged in the last 5 years or so of the word metaverse. Can you talk to me about, for you, what that means?
So I am conflicted about the metaverse. I basically treat any new technology trend with a huge amount of skepticism. Crypto, the metaverse, it's all been kind of lumped together in this digital future. And it is, in many ways, there's many pitfalls, right? So I look at the metaverse as almost, I don't want to say the original definition because there's no real agreed upon definition, but the idea is that there will be only one. And I think that's the important point about the original vision for the metaverse. There weren't many metaverses. It wasn't like there'd be the Microsoft metaverse and the Google metaverse and the open source metaverse when this concept was first envisaged in various science fiction writings. there was really one. You connected to the metaverse. It was an alternate world. Everybody kind of shared that space and experienced that space. And what we're seeing happen, however, not surprisingly, is that in the last kind of 5 years or so, since the term really hit the mainstream, is all of these different big technology companies jumping on board and putting their hat in the ring and saying, look, you know, we can build a metaverse. We can build a metaverse. And everyone has different definitions of what that might be. It got conflated with Web 3.0 and crypto somewhere along the line, that you need to be able to own land in the metaverse. You know, we saw what happened there with, for example, Decentraland, which didn't really take off. And so it's a bit of a mess. But the reason why I've been talking about the military metaverse specifically is that the military have a bit of a different mandate. Unlike some of these commercial tech companies that don't really know what to do with the metaverse, they don't really know how to make money from the metaverse, they don't really want to collaborate to build like a single shared metaverse, the military is working to solve very specific and well-defined problems. We need to train soldiers. We need to prepare them to deploy into theater. We need to leverage these technologies to train artificial intelligence and also inform those that are using the technology how to better train. So these are very well-defined problems, and there are metaverse concepts that the military is using in order to kind of better deliver these outcomes.
Excellent. No, that's a good rundown. So how do you, you know, I've heard a couple of people say, it's like, well, this, and this kind of what I was alluding to in the beginning, where, yeah, this concept of the metaverse really more just sounds like a rebranding of what we've already done, with a bunch of add-ons and complications along the way, with more industries jumping on the bandwagon and take advantage of it, right? But on the other hand, I asked a couple other geospatial companies, and I'm curious what your opinion is about what the metaverse is. And they said, it's like, well, we've always gotten into geospatial visualization, you know, visualizing the world, building 3D models, diving into it. But those have mainly been static in terms of how the data behaves. And our concept of the metaverse, I think the only true add-on is not just how engaging it is, how users can interact with the data, but how immersive it is. And what would you say on that that concept?
Yeah, I'd say that's there are people who believe that the metaverse needs to be immersive. You know, I've seen that written down. I personally believe that the fundamental difference between traditional simulation, traditional networking, and what we need for the metaverse is that we're moving from a traditional client-server architecture into this cloud architecture, where a lot of the simulation, a lot of the artificial intelligence is being kind of managed on the cloud in a scalable way, right? So when I think of a metaverse, the metaverse for military training, let's imagine a city, okay? So today, it's very difficult for military simulation to simulate 2 to 3 million people that live in a city, which means that it's very difficult for the military to, in simulation, drive a convoy down a road at rush hour in New York, and then there is some maybe a terrorist event, a bomb goes off, and that has this kind of rippling effect. It affects traffic flows. It affects first responders. There are hundreds of thousands of individual entities that sort of respond. Things happen across the entire city as a result of, for example, a terrorist attack. And today, that's very difficult to simulate, period. It can be done, but it's extremely difficult, and it's almost impossible to do it with humans in the loop. Humans actually driving vehicles in a convoy while this populated city kind of reacts to this event.
You're talking about scaled realism, per se.
Exactly, scaled realism. So you know, this is a problem that hasn't been solved, especially in virtual sim. Yeah, we can do scenarios with hundreds or thousands of AI entities, but not millions. But cloud technologies allow us to scale up on the cloud. We can run hundreds or thousands of individual services that simulate all of these entities in this city. We can pull our terrain data from other services to render that city and give the artificial intelligence the information that it needs to path plan and make smart decisions on this massive scale. So, in my mind, metaverse, the metaverse, needs to be able to deliver this kind of experience. Now, does it need to be immersive in the sense that I need to be able to put on a headset and walk around it? Well, it kind of depends. You know, maybe for mission planners, they just need the 2D map with all the entities kind of visualized or some military symbology. But certainly for the human participants, then, you know, it does need to be immersive. But for me, that's the step change. It's not the immersive nature or the online nature or the support for virtual reality or mixed reality. It's really this, the ability to simulate real populated spaces and engage with those big populated spaces.
Excellent. No, I thank you for the clarification. So in the last, we'll say 5 years or so, how do you see this adoption for taking root in the community? You know, how do you, and not specifically towards the concept of the metaverse, but as what, even what you're doing in training simulation in terms of the military, how do you see that have as grown and scaled up?
Right. Yeah. So yeah, I'm going to stick to the military because that's obviously my area of expertise. And, the vast majority of militaries that we work with, and we work with more than 60 NATO and NATO-friendly countries, they're quite happy with the traditional architectures, which means client-server, relatively small scenarios. But then there are these really forward-looking organizations, you may have heard of one of them, the U.S. Army, that is really thinking about how to build its own metaverse to solve the kinds of problems that I've been describing, right? So I've written about synthetic training environments, STI. We are a contractor on that. Most of my writing is Pete's opinion, by the way. I'm actually not involved in the day-to-day on that contract, but I am aware of the ambition of the Army, and they definitely want to solve megacities in the way that I've described. And they're investing in that very heavily. They're investing in this cloud architecture that moves the simulation onto services running on that cloud, and the cloud then scales up depending on the available compute power, which means that we can run this military metaverse in a battle simulation center on computers in the corner of the lab, or we can run it on the Amazon or on the Microsoft Azure stack or cloud and really scale it up. And so they are actively planning to turn all their old simulations off and turn on the synthetic training environment at some point in the future to deliver this step change and that kind of scale that I'm talking about. That scale, to me, like I said, is really part of what I consider necessary for a metaverse, if you want to use that term.
Great. No. So how much does it need to scale? You know, what's necessary? Does it need to be the whole world, or how big does a scenario really need to become effective?
So it's about 2.5 to 3 million in the requirements that I've seen, in the public domain, and that's because of the type of scenario that I've described. Right now, that's a huge gap in military sim. They just can't simulate that. Now the entire planet's pretty big, but the problem there is that you really only need to simulate what is going to be affected by the event that you're simulating. Right. So I'm not saying that you couldn't have more abstraction or lower fidelity for larger populations outside of the city or the immediate area of interest. And those could maybe dynamically increase in fidelity if necessary. But sort of 2 to 3 million is the current sweet spot that we're looking at. What that means for our company, we do virtual battle space, typically tactical simulation. We've upgraded our rendering engine to support tens or hundreds of thousands of entities in the field of view. It's still maintaining very high frame rates. And we are building VBS workers, we call them. Those are cloud scalable containers that can simulate many, many entities at very high fidelity using the available compute power. So we're also, in addition to our customers like the Army, transitioning our technology to prepare for this type of deployment.
Excellent. Now, you touched on, a lot of this moving, the development in parallel to cloud computing and cloud storage, of course. Can you talk a little bit more about the background and infrastructure demands, especially to reach that benchmark of 2 to 3 million? What are we talking about here? Where did what do you, not just the companies, but what does the government kind of have to account for reaching this objective?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And the challenge really is that I spoke about the requirement for 2 to 3 million. there is a requirement for that to run in a typical battle simulation center, which means that you don't have access to Amazon or Azure. You have a stack in the corner of the room that needs to run this many entities. So we're working on dynamic transfer of control, for example, where we can simulate entities at low fidelity. And then if you look at that area, then all of a sudden those entities will be simulated at much higher fidelity. So entities might just be moving every 5 seconds down the road center line. But if you look there, all of a sudden they'll snap to their lanes. They'll do collision avoidance. They might be animated more accurately, for example. And we're still figuring a lot of this out because we're really only kind of doing this type of scale for the first time. If you've ever played Grand Theft Auto, that's really what the military is looking for. You know, very high fidelity, realistic, believable cities to stimulate these complex training use cases. So we don't really have the luxury of unlimited processing power in the cloud. Now we've seen,
and that probably begs to differ, right? No, it's a big difference, but that probably brings up a good issue because since even the Army has always requested a lot of these resources to obviously have be home based, but there's always this this demand on the side for them to have a lot of these resources to have some type of partition on the edge, you know, edge computing as well, and edge resources so that they can deploy with these same capabilities. But it sounds like they're a long way from achieving that when they can't even get the core objective reached yet, right?
Well, I actually think they've come quite a long way. So they have architected this with that edge compute capability in mind from the very beginning. So they've started at the right place. They've started at the smaller scale. They're making sure that can work and then scaling up there. And they're running regular soldier touch points, soldiers of all levels of command, from the individual soldier right up to the commanders, using this STE architecture to kind of simulate training. So they're actually quite far along. The next phase really is scaling it up and seeing how high we can go. And one of the best things about the way the Army has approached this is really truly agile. So it's been pretty impressive to watch them rapidly prototype, get soldiers involved, direct soldier feedback, informing development of the technology. The Army's really learned a lot of lessons over the years about this type of procurement. And as a result, I mean, it looks like within a couple of years, there'll be some really good capability deployed to the field to solve problems that they haven't solved yet.
Now, you've touched specifically on the training aspect of this, especially when it relates to your company. Can you touch a little bit, even generically, on some of the other use cases, even specific to the military, on how this technology can benefit across a wide range of mission workloads, for example?
Yes. So this is where terrain really comes into play. And this is another area where Bohemia, our company, has been heavily involved. So we do the tactical simulation in VBS, but we also have a subsidiary company, TerraSim, that's been building tools for terrain correlation for 25 years. And a lot of their technology and a lot of our technology has sort of come together in a new platform called Mantle ETM. The ETM stands for Enterprise Terrain Management. And that's the same technology that the Army is exploiting in certain parts of synthetic training environment to take terrain data from really any conceivable source, procedurally enhance that data, which means make it more real, and then stream it out to multiple runtime engines. And this is very, very important because different game engines, different simulations are suited to different tasks. If you are, in GeoInt, for example, GeoInt, and you're really wanting technology to train analysts, for example, then you might want to use a high fidelity game engine with thermal imaging capability. You might want to simulate the view from a satellite or the view from a high flying UAS. But if you're training a commander of a brigade, then you don't need that kind of fidelity. High fidelity sort of gets in the way of the training. You need a map. So streaming out this terrain data, still correlated to all of these different connected runtime simulations is really, really important. And so we see a lot of potential in adjacent markets, including non-military markets, to take advantage of what we're doing in the terrain space. We just did a partnership with a company called Black Shark AI, who effectively procedurally generate the entire planet. Their technology is used in Microsoft Flight Simulator, the latest one, to really render an unbelievably realistic digital twin of planet Earth.
And they are working with Maxar to get a lot of the data in their system. So,
yeah, exactly. So we can pull in the Maxar content, and we can conflate or merge that with other content from other providers, and then we can stream that out to Unreal, VBS, Unity, different constructive simulations, Cesium, of course, as well. But then we've gone one step further. In addition to just streaming out this terrain to multiple runtimes, we're also working on support for dynamic terrain across runtimes. So let's imagine that you're doing a training scenario and there's an explosion, it blows up a bridge. Our technology can then take that event, make those changes on the server, and then you'll see the exact output in all of those different runtimes as well. So this is solving what's called the dynamic terrain correlation problem, which has been an issue across many industries for many, many years. So we're tackling a lot of aspects, but the terrain piece is certainly of the most interest, I think, outside of the military.
Now, where do you get the terrain data from specifically? I mean, do you know what satellite vendor it's usually come from? Maxar is not usually known for terrain data per se. Usually it's bigger radar companies that produce terrain data. For example, Airbus produces the Global DIM, which is probably the highest precision Global DIM model in the world right now. Or a lot of companies still revert back to the older SRTM, the satellite, the shuttle mission terrain data.
Yeah, it's pretty famous. Yeah. So we use that too. But I mean, the U.S. Army right now has a really big contract with Maxar for One World Terrain, which is part of STE, and that's a lot of 3D data, satellite sourced primarily 3D data, which provides really good fidelity to 500 feet. Under 500 feet, it begins to look like melted wax, but that's where our tech comes in, and we can procedurally enhance based upon building footprints and such. We work a lot with Lux Carter, Blackshark.ai, I've already mentioned. We support Microsoft, Bing, we support Google Maps, and then we support custom data. The NGA, for example, has a lot of custom data in various repositories that we ingest as well. So yeah, we really try to keep it as open as we can. And then the rendering engines themselves vary widely. Although we are seeing 3D tiles really become the standard for 3D data. The issue is it's kind of slow. That's the problem with 3D tiles. It's dense data. So sometimes when you're streaming, you're better off to do procedural generation on the engine side. But yeah, there's a lot of detail there, and it's a fascinating area to be involved in for sure.
Oh yeah, well that's a lot of our audience is they deal with that. They're collectors of that data, and it's useful to know how it gets used down the chain, right? So they generate that data as well. So to touch a little bit briefly on a few other aspects of it, where I'd like to kind of know just more of how you've seen this technology grow over the years. What's the biggest, we'll call it, wow moment you've had in realizing how much it has grown?
Yeah, so for me, there have been a number of different step changes. So on the geospatial side, the step change from sort of texture data, satellite imagery or aerophotography to 3D data from photogrammetry, which has been around about 10 years now. I mean, don't quote me, there'll be people out there who know better than me. Like that was the first big step change. I mean, I was in the room when the US Army sort of saw the 3D data from Maxar for the first time. And it was truly impressive. And all of a sudden, the Army's mindset shifted from legacy terrain generation, where we take building footprints and shape files and we kind of extrude that and we do the best we can, to, well, why not just have photorealistic 3D data from photogrammetry? And so that was a big step change, to be sure. And then on the scalability front, so talking about cloud-enabled simulation, we saw a lot of investment around that. In the UK, of course, we had Improbable really heavily investing in this idea of cloud-based scalability. And that opened up the US Army's mind to, well, we can do entity-level simulation into the millions. We don't need to abstract the problem away or aggregate the problem away. We don't need to do purely probabilistic simulation when we can simulate a million entities on the cloud and do physical simulation and actually simulate every round that travels through the air. So there's been, over the last 10 years, these kind of fundamental breakthroughs that have opened up the minds of our customers specifically to the art of the possible. I also must say, too, that, you know, while this is all very exciting and new, leveraging game technology, the latest geospatial technology, there's also been big advances in military standards. So people's eyes might glaze over, but you know, good old-fashioned HLA, high-level architecture, the way that military simulations communicate has really advanced. And the most recent, or the upcoming release of HLA 4 is really exciting. It's very high performance, and it should enable us to take advantage of some cloud scalability there as well. So yeah, there's a lot of really exciting investment and big advances. And then I have to mention machine learning. Of course. Now, machine learning has always been an aspiration of the military, but the synthetic training environment should enable that to become a reality, because all of a sudden, all of these battle simulation centers, all of the people that are using this STI, it's all connected back, which means we can actually you know, track the data. We can look at the decisions that commanders are making across the Army, how they solve the same problem set. And you really do need that type of well-structured data to inform machine learning and better artificial intelligence. And ultimately, the panacea there is AI that tells the commander the best, safest, most efficient way to accomplish a mission. And yes, ChatGPT is huge, but we still don't have good AI that says, okay, Mr. Commander, based upon all the information you've given me, here's how you should assault the objective. But technologies like STI should enable that for the first time.
Excellent. Yeah, that's awesome. And this is where you're seeing these epiphanies over the last couple of years of we finally might be able to do it soon.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, the advances in the last 10 years, I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years, basically, because from the Army, the last 10 years, yeah, the advances have been mind-blowing, really. And I'm really excited to be involved.
As we're approaching the end of our conversation a little bit, I want to actually hit on, where do you see the biggest obstacles in the industry? Where do you see the biggest obstacles that we still have to overcome, whether that be culturally or technologically? And I'm sure you're dealing with some of that yourself, whether it be with your current customers or you're still striving to, you know, reach certain benchmarks, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky question, and it really does. Really does depend on which military you're describing, and I believe that computer game technology. I mean, I truly believe and have seen it train soldiers. There are still militaries around the world where we run into this cultural problem where the old salty commanders or warrant officers believe that, you know, if it ain't raining, it ain't training, as they say, right? Unless you're in the field with your boots muddy, you're not training. And so we still are coming up with that mindset. And that's not such an issue in the US Army anymore. 10 years ago, it was. 10 years ago, my investors would advise me, Pete, don't talk about computer games. Don't talk about computer games. You're talking about games too much, because they were scared that the generals would be frightened away. But now, especially in the US Army and the US Marine Corps, that mindset has changed. So there's not really cultural issues left, especially in the U.S. military.
Perhaps not in the technology per se. I think it's more into the data, questioning the data between what they're used to with hard sensors compared to synthetic data, I think is still a barrier that is still overcoming, right?
Yeah.
The synthetic data, the synthetic imagery industry or movement is still fairly young. And there's still a lot of stereotypes behind that right now, whether that be things that Black Shark is making or render.ai or synthetic, another new synthetic data company out there. But those are the issues they're more struggling with, is like, hey, no, we can accurately simulate real radar imagery, thermal imagery, and it passes muster. And there's a lot of, there's a lot of cultural barriers behind recognizing that it's just as good as the real stuff.
Yeah, understood. And it's so much better than we used to have.
Oh yeah.
So I think that also understanding how to best use this tech in training and operations, like we're still catching up. We're catching up there. Security is always a concern. You know, getting ATO's authority to operate and anything to do with cloud security becomes a massive concern. There is
security still way behind the curve in adopting or allowing the movement up of stuff.
I wouldn't say it's fast, but I mean, I can only speak to, you know, the customers I've worked with, like the U.S. Army, but yeah, what I see.
Usually the ATO process, the biggest hurdles have been usually the standards for ATO have not always addressed the emerging file formats we didn't know this type of code exists. We even have anybody to approve this. How does this?
It's pretty good. Like DevSecOps now and this area, I have to say I'm quite impressed. So yeah,
excellent.
They're moving pretty quick.
I don't usually hear the ATO getting a positive.
Well, we just got an ATO from a 3-letter agency in the US, and it was quite a painless process. I can say. And so I'm just thinking about obstacles and hurdles, and really I think there is unfortunately a lot of investment required to go from legacy simulation to this new cloud enabled model like STI. Now the US Army can do it, has a big budget, clear defined problems it's trying to solve. But yeah, I do think that other militaries, if they wish to upgrade to a STI-like concept, synthetic training environment-like concept, then you know, it is very much a reimagining of how you do simulation across your entire enterprise. So that is going to be a challenge for the smaller militaries that are out there.
Well, Pete, I want to thank you for joining us. I want to give you one last chance to, if you have any shout-outs or plugs, whether that be your company or talking about the way ahead for what you do with modeling, simulation, and training.
I mean, I would just add that we are really excited about becoming a terrain company in addition to a tactical training company. So, we've focused so narrowly on the military over the years, quite intentionally, but now for the first time, we're taking one step out, but really trying to find our own place in the market. Supporting any data provider. You know, what we're really focusing on here is correlated terrain streamed to multiple runtimes that can dynamically update. And I believe we're one of the first companies to be working on this problem set. We're going to be at ITEC in a few weeks. And if people want to learn more about what we're doing there, please reach out. Otherwise, it's been really enjoyable talking to you about the metaverse, however you might define it, for sure.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you. This is Adam Simmons for Project Geospatial, and we'll talk to everybody next time.